Good morning. I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Tuesday, the 27th of March. Coming up in just a moment, David Korn will be joining us. Showdown is his latest book. He says it is a behind-the-scenes narrative covering the White House from the disastrous 2010 midterm elections until what he calls the promising start of 2012, how President Barack Obama got his groove back in time for the re-election campaign. It chronicles so many issues, the lame duck session victories, the agonizing budget and debt ceiling battles. Also, it looks at the handling of the uprisings in Egypt and Libya and the Osama bin Laden mission. David Korn will be joining us. You see him frequently on television as a commentator, and he is our guest. He's also Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. He'll be with us momentarily. As you may know by now, we are in our spring membership drive. I'm Kathleen Dunn, and Ellen Clark is joining me in our Milwaukee studios. We are here to ask you to invest a mere 3 minutes of your time in your own future. Our goal to ensure that all of the programs that you value, including this one, are here on Wisconsin Public Radio when you want them. A contribution of any amount will do just that. Please make your gift now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we know you're listening. Last hour's goal was 350 pledges. We heard from 480 listeners.
Amazing.
Thank you. Thank you for those pledges. But as you know, with a pledge drive, we are not done yet. Our goal this hour is 45 pledges, and I think we can make that. It'd be neat if we got 450.
It would. I'm not sure we will.
Match last hour's goal, but let's think 45. About it, though. Yeah. We can make that goal with your contribution at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And isn't it nice to know that the programs you enjoy will be here every day on Wisconsin Public Radio because of your support?
The Ideas Network, of course, is with you all day long. You're driving to work, you're going to do errands, you're cooking dinner, you're washing the dishes, you're playing with the dog, you're playing with the children, you're listening at home or at work. You're getting really interesting and important, I might add, discussions whenever you want them. We're always here. You make that possible with your donation. Wisconsin Public Radio would not be what it is without your support. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And as added incentive, we have something exciting going on this pledge drive. When you pledge any amount, you're entered into a drawing, and what it is a trip for two on a garden tour of London and the surrounding area with our very own Larry Mueller. That sounds wonderful. Find out the details and make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
In just a moment, we'll be talking, you will as well, to David Korn from Mother Jones Magazine, author of Showdown, about the Obama administration. It's a fascinating book. Discussions like these are possible really only because of your financial support. We need you. Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You give to Wisconsin Public Radio to support the programs, but as an added incentive, we have a special gift for you this time.
We sure do. You can receive Showdown, which I have read. Yesterday, I got a lot of books this week, but I did read the book yesterday, and it's fascinating. It's an inside look at the Obama administration since the disastrous midterm elections. And we've spent so much time analyzing politics nationally and locally. Those of you who are listening now will love this book. When you donate $180 or more, you can receive Showdown. So please ask for it now when you make your pledge of $180. But really, your gift of any amount is appreciated. WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And giving really could not be easier. You just go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. We just need a few minutes of your time, 3 minutes, I believe we said. You'll give us your name, your contact information, the amount of your pledge, and how you'd like to pay it.
And if you'd like to save time and money, use a credit card if you can, or sign up for that automatic sustaining donations from your bank account. You choose how to give, and then you do it at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we are still looking for about 39 more pledges. We've already gotten 6, so thanks so much for your calls. If you haven't called yet, please help us out now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. 2552.
Ask for Showdown with your pledge of $180 or more. Pledge now, WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
And also with your pledge of any amount, you'll be entered in that drawing for a trip for two on a garden tour of London, England. You can get details and pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
I like this comment. Ellen, Kathy writes in, thanks for all you do. You make our dinner time conversations so much more enjoyable.
And isn't that the truth?
That really is the truth. Many of my dinner time conversations are filled with this as well.
Does it start with, did you hear?
Yes.
On Wisconsin
yes.
Public Radio?
No, yeah, it is. I hope you were listening today.
You're right.
Family. All right, here we go with David Korn. It's a really interesting book, and I think we're going to have a fascinating conversation with him. Showdown is the name of David's new book, and there is a subtitle to it, The Inside Story of How Obama Fought Back Against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. David describes the book this way, a behind-the-scenes narrative covering the White House from the disastrous 2010 midterm elections until the promising start of 2012. It looks at a number of issues, the debate over the budget and the debt ceiling battles. It looks at uprisings in Egypt and how the president maneuvered a fine line here in dealing with the democracy movement and with President Mubarak. It looks at Libya, the Osama bin Laden mission, and a number of other issues, and how he is focusing and maybe changing somewhat as he goes into the 2012 election. David Korn is the Washington Bureau Chief for Mother Jones Magazine. He was the editor of The Nation for 20 years, analyst for MSNBC and NBC News, the author of the New York Times bestsellers Hubris with Michael Isikoff and The Lies of George W. Bush. He has written for The New York Times, Washington Post, Atlantic, Harper's, New Republic, and we'll be welcoming phone calls for him. I think that there will be quite a few. Our on-air number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Hi, David.
Hi, thanks for having me.
Yeah, thank you so much. My husband many years ago gave me the whole set of West Wing, and I just started watching it because we did a show on West Wing. I'm a little late to watching this again, but I've been watching episode after episode, and I read your book, and I thought, I feel like I'm seeing West Wing again. It's been it's been great, but it is like that, isn't it?
Well, it's highly dramatic. It revolves around the White House. It revolves around personalities, and it's all about the intersection of politics and policy and governing. So I think there is a lot. I mean, I felt privileged to be able to write this book, which really covers, you know, is behind the scenes look at the Obama White House from the midterm elections until really the start of the campaign season this year. That I feel privileged to be able to get access to people in the White House who could talk about these things that we watch from the outside and really get an understanding of what the president is doing, what he's thinking, whether or not I agreed with him was almost immaterial. To me, it was just rather fascinating, and I've been very pleased with the response I've gotten from readers who do say they feel like a fly on the wall.
Right.
When they read this book.
Yeah. Let's talk about his philosophy for a moment, because we've spent so much time trying to analyze who he is, what he's thinking. Is he a secret progressive? Is he a centrist? What is he? You say early on in the book that a factor shaping his thinking is that he was the president of all Americans, even those who had not voted for him, not merely the leader of a political party.
Yeah, and what I mean by that, too, and you know, I've spoken to people around him, I've been in his presence and heard him talk about this, you know, when you're president, you're a political leader, you're the leader of the Democratic Party, you care about those things, you're the leader of the government, you have to make the government just work, but you also have to think about the people out there who need the government more than others and how to make things right for them. So the context of that remark was very much related to the tax cut compromise of December 2010, shortly after the midterms election, in which the Democrats were routed by the Republicans, and the Republicans took control of the House, and John Boehner became Speaker. In that tax cut fight, there were some liberal and progressive Democrats, particularly in the House, who were egging on Obama to have a big major fight with the with the Republicans over extending the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. Obama was against extension. He had campaigned against it. He believed that it was not right. It's not part of the shared sacrifice he's been talking about, and was against it 100%. And it was a campaign promise. But he saw that if he didn't put together a compromise at the end of this lame duck session before the House Republicans took control of the House, which would make anything more difficult come January 2011, if he didn't do that, then 2 million Americans would not get the unemployment benefits that were about to run out that he wanted to extend as part of this package, and tens of millions of middle-class, low-income Americans would see their taxes go up because the Bush tax cuts that affected middle- and low-income Americans would also not go forward if there was no compromise, if there was no legislative measure put together. So he was thinking, okay, he had this political stance. You know, it was driven by policy. They didn't want Bush tax cuts for the wealthy. But he also didn't want to harm people who needed the unemployment benefits. He didn't want to see middle- and low-income Americans have their tax bills go up, which would also have a negative impact on the fragile economic recovery. So he has all these things that he has to sort through. His responsibility for making sure people get what they need to have secure families, his sort of honesty or his loyalty to his political positions, and it was a tough decision. But I think in the end, it was sort of a gutsy decision. People accused him of capitulating to the Republicans and of flip-flopping by accepting the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, a continuation of them, but only for 2 years, a temporary continuation. But in some ways, you can also look at it as a sacrifice of a political stand in order to get a policy win, which gave him basically a second stimulus of $240 billion of stimulus funding that he couldn't otherwise get through the Senate because of the Republican filibuster. So he got a lot, he gave a little, and it really sort of, to me, crystallized some of the knotty dilemmas that a person like Barack Obama faces when he's president.
All of the polls showed for a long time, obviously, that jobs were a huge issue here. I was interested in a meeting that you outlined when Paul Krugman and Robert Reich were in the White House, and Reich left saying that Obama didn't have a compelling economic tale to tell. He was criticized by a number of progressives for not really taking on the issue of jobs when all Americans were saying, not all, but most of them were saying this is the number one issue. Was that criticism justified?
Well, I think in a way it was. The argument that Robert Reich and others have made, and it was, this meeting occurred in around the time of the tax cut deal in December 2010, but it was an argument that they continued, the liberal critics, through the budget fight last year. Remember when the government almost came to a shutdown?
Mm-hmm.
During the debt ceiling tussle, which almost ended in a financial crisis and did end with a Standard & Poor's downgrading the U.S. Credit rating. And through all that period, people kept saying, listen, the president may be negotiating the best deals he can or has to avert negative consequences. In the case I just described, it was tax cuts going up for the middle class and unemployed losing benefits. In the budget fight, it was a government shutdown that the White House feared would, and I think reasonably, might cause a double-dip recession if there was a government shutdown. And in the third case, the debt ceiling, there was no doubt that there would be tremendous financial implications if the U.S. government had a default. And it might even be a Greek-type crisis. So while they were negotiating compromises to avert these negative consequences that were really, being brought to bear by Republican or Tea Party recalcitrants or hostage-taking, as the president likened it to, that he did what he had to do. But at the same time, he lost, I think, a lot of the message wars during that. So Republicans came in and they said that the only thing wrong with the economy is that the government spends too much and we just have to cut. That is not, I think, the view of many liberal or even centrist economists who talk about the need to invest, the need to cut. If you're going to cut wisely and not immediately because you don't want an economic contraction. caused by, you know, government spending less money. But I think in the budget fight and the debt ceiling fight, there was so much attention paid to the proposed cuts that it overwhelmed the economic narrative that the president was trying to tell, which began, we would say, with the State of the Union speech when he talked about winning the future at the beginning of 2010. He talked about the need to, you know, cut smartly to do something about our deficits, but also to spend wisely on investments that are needed to make sure the U.S. can compete with emerging economic powers throughout the century, and that we keep our social safety net secure. So often he lost track of that economic narrative, plus the element that the reason we're in the hole we're in today is not because of government spending. It wasn't government spending that led to the subprime crisis, that led to the financial meltdown, that led to the loss of 8 million jobs. It had nothing to do with the government. It had to do with Wall Street recklessness. And I think the president, in some ways, he talks about it now, and he to a certain degree, lost track of that thread. So while he was doing what he needed to do, the Republic, and even sometimes bettering the Republicans in the outright negotiations, Republicans were sometimes getting the better of him in terms of the thematic showdown. But having said all that, I think by the end of 2011, the beginning of this year, the president reached a point where his overall economic message and his message of sort of a different vision and values than the Republicans. And you see that just in the last week or two with fighting over the new
Yes.
budget, right? I think he's in a better position now than the Republicans. But it was ugly getting there.
Let's spend a few minutes talking about Osama bin Laden. And let me give you our on-air phone number, too, if you want to join the conversation with David. Please do so now, 800-486-8655. The area of the book where he really functions with a great deal of nuance and understanding, and where I think he shines, is in foreign policy. The raid on Osama bin Laden was terribly risky for him. As I was thinking as I was reading that chapter, David, what would have happened if this had not gone well? Could have brought him down, but it was quite decisive, very, very well analyzed, and an incredibly risky thing for him to do.
Well, I think it was. I mean, it's the type of thing that if it succeeds, people will give you lots of credit, but then the credit probably will diminish over time as other things come to bear. But if it goes poorly or ends in a disaster, which really could, we can sit here for the next hour and envision hundreds of scenarios when this thing could have blown up and could have ended up with firefight,
yes.
A firefight between
yes.
U.S. and Pakistani forces, or imagine if the whole compound had been wired and Bin Laden hadn't been there that moment, and it blew up, killing all these women and kids. You could have demonstrations throughout Pakistan. It could actually lead to tremendous instability in Pakistan. And remember, it's a nuclear nation. So there are a lot of things that could go wrong in this mission, which would, I don't think it's overly dramatic to say, would have ended Barack Obama's presidency. The failure of Desert One really had tremendous implications for Jimmy Carter's presidency when he tried to mount a rescue operation for the hostages being held in the Iranian embassy, and it flopped in the desert, and it became a metaphor for Jimmy Carter's fecklessness at a time of economic trouble, which we have now, of course. So I think there was a lot on the line, and there were people in the room with Barack Obama who had worked on Desert One and Black Hawk Down, which happened in Somalia a few years later, another disaster involving helicopters. And they were, not keen on this mission. And what I report in my book is there's this meeting the day before Barack Obama makes his final decision. This is, I think, Thursday, April 28th or so. And the CIA, which had been studying the intelligence on the Abbottabad compound for, almost a year, not quite a year, had given it a 60 to 80% certainty that the fellow who was in the compound was bin Laden. So 60 to 80%. But then, as often happens in the intelligence world, they conducted what's called a red team exercise. That's when you take the existing intelligence that's been reviewed, and you take it away from the analyst who have been working with it for all this time, and you give it to a new set of analysts who haven't been working on it, completely, you know, they come in with fresh eyes, no assumptions, and you say, okay, you do a review for us and tell us what conclusions you reach. And they came in with a lower degree of certainty, 40 to 60%.
Oh, my.
So, you know, not none, but here we are getting closer to the D-Day for the decision, and the certainty level is going down. And so the president has a meeting with, and only a couple of top aides, national security aides, knew about this. You know, this was kept within a really small circle of advisors. So you have this meeting with these folks, and Obama goes around the table asking for the final recommendations. Joe Biden, his vice president, Bob Gates, his secretary of defense, both say, don't go. Let's see if we can get better intelligence on this. There are some people in the room who say, let's just do this with a missile strike from a standoff position, which Obama had sort of ruled out earlier because of collateral damage and because you might be hard to determine if indeed you blew up bin Laden, you know, who would be left in all that rubble if he were there. And so the other option was this helicopter raid. And Leon Panetta, who was then the CIA chief, and one or two others favored it. But the thing to remember here is that recommendation, that course of action, as they call it, was supported by less than half the people in the room.
Remarkable.
Most were against it or for something else. And so here's the president, and let's be honest about this. This is a guy who never was in the military, you know, was a senator for 4 years, didn't have a lot of military experience or national security experience in the Senate, and he has to make this tough call. And his top guys, Joe Biden, Bob Gates, those are his top national security advisors, they're saying, we don't think you should do this.
David Korn is our guest, and we're going to welcome phone calls for him. His book is Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. David is the Washington bureau chief for Mother Jones Magazine. He's also an analyst frequently on television on MSNBC and NBC News, author of a number of other books as well. I just want to remind you that we are in a pledge drive, and if you can pledge $180, we'll be more than happy to thank you for that pledge with a gift of David's new book, Showdown. 800-486-8655 is our number to your calls in a moment. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Let's take a call, and Victor in Milwaukee. Hi, Victor.
Good morning. Good morning to your guest. How was President Obama's relationship with the Black Congressional Congress? Because one would assume that him being a black president and he had the Black Congressional Congress, they would be of one thought. But occasionally there was some dissension between them, particularly with Maxine Waters. What was her criticism of him? On the international front, has our policy or our relationship with the African countries improved? Because during the Bush administration, they were pushing for anti-terrorism. It seemed like it was a one-way foreign policy. But as far as economic development, how would you grade President Obama?
Well, let's talk about the first half of that question first. He's had a testy relationship at times with all Democrats on the Hill. Particularly progressive Democrats, who and you'd put the Congressional Black Caucus in that group. I don't think there's anything particular about Maxine Waters, but when he was trying to say do the debt ceiling grand bargain deal, you had the leaders of the Congressional Black Caucus very upset with him for trying to put together a compromise that would call for some entitlement savings. By that I mean raising the eligibility age of Medicare very gradually over a long period of time, and making some changes to the cost of living adjustment for Social Security, which would make it a little less generous, again gradually over a period of time, and also exempting, you know, the very poor from some of those changes. And so they didn't like that, but that was Obama's way of saying, I'm for, you know, I think we have to get our fiscal house in order. In order to do that, I'm willing to make some entitlement changes, but only if the Republicans reciprocate by allowing us to get more tax revenues, either through tax reform, which we still want it to be progressive, or tax changes that bring in more money from the well-to-do and profitable corporations. So that was that caused, I think, you know, there was a lot of friction over that. That was sort of the last big source of friction between him and the Congressional Black Caucus and other liberal Democrats on the Hill. That deal all fell apart largely because the Republicans, John Boehner, could not make that deal and still retain the support of the Tea Partiers in his caucus, who don't want to raise any taxes whatsoever on anybody, you know, in the upper income categories. So, but since then, the president has taken more of a populist confrontational approach with the Republicans, and I think that has heartened liberal progressive Democrats, including members of the Congressional Black Caucus. But, you know, the president, as we talked about earlier, you know, has a different set of priorities sometimes than members of Congress, and members of Congress, particularly when they're in the minority, as House Democrats are now, often have more latitude to say and act in a political way because they have no responsibility for governing, which the president indeed does possess. And the second half of the question concerned
Africa
in terms of foreign aid.
In terms of our relationship with African countries?
Well, I think, you know,
take it from Egypt, because you write a lot about it.
You know, you can look at Egypt and you look at Libya. I mean, those are the places where he's made most of a mark here. And I think the chapter in my book, Showdown on Egypt, is fascinating because it shows, at least it is to me.
It was to me, too,
oh, well,
David.
Good. Thank you. Because it shows how the president was, as a lot of his aides said, this is their word, leaning forward, and that he was ahead of the sort of the government, his own administration, and seeing that what was happening in Egypt was foundational, was fundamental, and couldn't be put back in the bottle, and he had these conversations with Hosni Mubarak, in which he basically kept encouraging him to either implement reforms early on or to leave, you know, as the crisis got worse. And Mubarak was just not, you know, really listening to him. And from the outside, though, he was not attacking Mubarak in his public statements because he was trying to maintain the influence that he and his administration could have, not just on Mubarak, but on the Egyptian military and other Egyptian officials. So, and at the same time, he was facing resistance from some of his top national security advisors who thought he was going too far. There was an interesting moment in this chapter occurs before the demonstrations begin in Egypt. They began on January 25th, 2011. But on January 18th, a week earlier, Barack Obama is having a phone conversation with Mubarak. And every couple of months, he would talk to Mubarak. This was a routine phone call, and they'd talk about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and any prospects for peace talks. They talk about terrorism issues, and on this particular call, it was after the Tunisian revolution. The president said to Mubarak, "You know, look what just happened in Tunisia. This shows that this can happen anywhere. It also shows that leaders in the Arab world have to get ahead of this democratic impulse that is going to be moving through from country to country. In other words, start reforming now. You know, this could," he was saying in a very polite way, "this could happen to you. But the way to forestall this or prevent this from happening to you is to start making changes, real changes, now." And Mubarak just, you know, shrugged it off and didn't really engage with the president on that level. So he was, that is, Obama, had some foresight about what was going to happen, and he was willing, you know, even though it didn't always seem that way from the outside, to be pressuring Mubarak behind the scenes to make changes and then to leave.
David Korn is our guest, and we're going to welcome more phone calls. Victor, thank you for yours. His latest book is Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. It outlines what's been going on with the president, his advisors, world leaders since the disastrous midterm elections, and how he's preparing himself for this election in 2012. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. We need to take a few moments to tell you that we're in our spring membership drive. And for those of you who can pledge $180, we'll be happy to send you a copy of this book that's getting a great deal of attention and is very, very well well done, Showdown. That's for $180. And the way to get that is to go to WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Ellen Clark is joining me in our studios. We're asking for you to put something back into Wisconsin Public Radio because we count on listener contributions to pay for just about everything we do. Your gift keeps the programs you value, including this one, on the air.
And we're looking for 45 pledges this hour. We still need 25. We can make that with your help. Your pledge right now helps keep Kathleen's programs really strong. And after all, what would we do without Kathleen's insights, her intelligence, and the conversation she has with her guests? Isn't this hour wonderful? Make your contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You hear from the person who has unique experience, the person who wrote the bill or wrote the book, like our guest David Korn. Last week it was Russ Feingold. Recently it was Senator George McGovern, all talking about similar issues from different perspectives. We are happy to seek these people out and get them on this show. Privileged, as a matter of fact. As David said, it was a privilege to write the book. It's a privilege to have these conversations every day. Please make great radio happen right now with your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And remember, with a pledge of $180, you can receive the book Showdown as a thank you gift. Your pledge helps support Wisconsin Public Radio programs, and I think you'll enjoy this thank you gift. That's Showdown, our guest David Korn's book, and that's for a pledge of $180 or more. And of course, your pledge of any amount supports WPR programs. We appreciate any and all pledges at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
One donor said, every day WPR brightens my mind, raises my spirit, and piques my curiosity. Another said, WPR is the best deal ever.
And thank you so much for those comments. I really don't think we could have said it better ourselves. If you are having these same thoughts running through your head as you're listening to Wisconsin Public Radio, maybe it's time to support with your gift at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're looking for how many pledges, Ellen?
We're looking for 45, and we need 25. We got kind of stuck at 25, so we need to get the ball rolling on here.
Well,
again,
let's do that. Ask for Showdown with your pledge of $180 or more. 888-202-2552 or WPR.org. Thank you, Ellen, very much. Ellen Clark joining me in our studios in downtown Milwaukee. David Korn is our guest. Showdown is the book, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. Our next caller is Jeff in River Falls. Hi, Jeff.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm an ongoing donor to
WPR.
And I'd like to say that I really respect the type of journalism that Mr. Korn practices. It's honest and well-researched and seems to be lacking in a lot of places. But my question is regarding the Bush tax cuts, which I think we all are aware are the main reason for the huge deficits. But it seems to me that Obama was able to really accomplish more stimulus by allowing those tax cuts to extend into the current years, because in effect, not taxing whether it's the rich or the middle class does allow more money to stay in the economy. So I think it was in effect a masterful strategic move on Obama's part to keep that money in the economy.
And you write about just that in the book, David.
Yeah, and I would say the tax cuts for the well-to-do, the Bush tax cuts for the well-to-do, have probably some mild stimulative impact, not enough probably to justify their impact on the deficit, their deficit causing consequences. So it was not the worst thing to extend them from that point of view, but the key thing was that by agreeing to this two-year extension with the Republicans on those upper income tax cuts, President Obama also got $240 billion in other stimulus money, extra unemployment benefits or continuing unemployment benefits that had run out, that Senate Republicans were blocking, but also continuing lots of tax credits that were in the original stimulus bill for middle and low-income Americans, and, of course, the now famous payroll tax cut, which was just extended, you had a big fight about that at the end of last year. So that was where the true genius was. It wasn't just accepting the Bush tax cuts for the rich because they have, you know, a very, very mild stimulative impact. It was because in doing so, the president was able to get all this other stimulus that there was no way. And when House, I write in the book, fly on the wall stuff. When I'm in meetings, the book is in meetings with the president and House Democrats who are urging him to fight, you know, the Bush tax cuts for the rich and just draw a line, play this game of chicken with Republicans. And he keeps, you know, asking them, what can you get that's better than this? You've had, you know, you're about to lose control of the House, and even though you've had control of both sides of Capitol Hill, you have not been able to extend unemployment benefits. You have not been able to continue these tax credits, largely because, you know, Senate Republicans used filibusters to block these provisions. So you have failed to deliver on these fronts. I can get this with this package. Plus, there was something else which he didn't say publicly. Maybe he should have at the time, although it might have, you know, made it harder to do this. With this tax cut compromise, he did it kind of fast. It was put together in a week or so, and it cleared the political space that was necessary for him to pass other legislation in that lame duck session before the House Republicans would come in, take control, and prevent the passage of anything. And that included, in that lame duck session, the repeal of the Don't Ask, Don't Tell ban on openly gay and lesbian service members in the Pentagon and in the armed forces. It included getting the New START treaty ratified. It included a child nutrition bill that the First Lady had been pushing for. It included a bill that would give health benefits to 9/11 rescue workers. It led to a vote on the DREAM Act, which got a majority. This is the immigration reform bill in the Senate, but not enough to defy a Republican filibuster. And so the president was told, and by his advisors, they worked this out, that if they had had a stand your ground, so to speak, tax fight with the Republicans over the Bush tax cuts for the wealthy, it would have taken up, it would have consumed all the time, limited time, in this limited lame duck session, and would not have allowed any consideration of these other measures. So, you know, in business terms, you'd say there was a tremendous opportunity cost to having that fight that the president thought he wouldn't win and that wouldn't deliver the second stimulus, like the caller just mentioned, and would take away all these other possibilities. So I don't think it's fully realized just how savvy he was in a tactical manner in using those last, you know, 6-7 weeks that he had following this historic loss to really achieve more legislative victories than I think any president has, at least in the last 100 years, in a lame duck session.
Thank you, Jeff, for the call. We go to Joshua in Madison. Hi, Joshua.
Hey. I just wanted to know how Mr. Korn kind of responds to this article in the New York Times about how the Republicans actually gave Obama everything he wanted, and he turned them down. So I just want to kind of get his thoughts.
Yeah, that story was in the Washington Post about 2 weeks ago. And I have a lot in my book on the back and forth on the debt ceiling fight during, you know, which there was an effort made for the grand bargain. And John Boehner walked out of that of those talks twice. The first time he walked out, which was not the subject of the Washington Post story, they focused on the second time. The first time he walked out occurred when he was having these secret negotiations that then became known publicly with the president that would have included some form of tax revenues in addition to the entitlement savings that I mentioned earlier in the show. And as he was having these conversations, negotiations with the White House, House moderate Republicans, a handful of them, who were friends with John Boehner, who would probably be glad to vote for this package, came to meet with Boehner and said, listen, Eric Cantor, the number two, the House Majority Leader, is going around our caucus and telling Republicans that you've gone rhino. Rhino means Republican in name only. It's like the worst insult you can hurl at a conservative. And they said that Boehner was waiting or ready or willing to lead a rebellion, a Tea Party rebellion against John Boehner. They said, you're too far over the tips of your skis. Get out now. And Boehner, hearing this from his colleagues, left the talks. Then about 10 days later, he and Cantor make an opening, an overture to the White House, and say they want to renew these talks again. But they're coming in offering less and asking more. But the White House is still willing to talk. And while these negotiations are proceeding again very delicately and carefully, the Senate Republicans and some Democrat senators put out, it's called the Gang of Six, put out a deficit reduction plan that calls for $1.5, maybe $2 trillion in new revenues. Boehner and the White House were talking about $800 billion. So at this point in time, there's now a plan coming out of the Senate with Republican support calling for twice as much, if not more than that, revenues than what Boehner has put on the table with the president. At that point, White House aides and then eventually the president say to Boehner aides and eventually to Boehner, listen, there is no way Democrats, they're trying to get a bipartisan package that will be voted for by both Republicans and Democrats. There's no way Democrats are going to accept this package if the revenues are below what Senate Republicans are endorsing, so far below. It's like the Gang of Six has moved the goalpost. So the president gave John Boehner an option. You can either go higher on revenues, which you may not want to do, but if you don't, then you have to go lower on the entitlement issues that we've talked about, that I've put on the table. So up on one side or down the other. And he said to Boehner, your choice. And Boehner went a whole day without returning the president's call and then announced publicly he was walking out of the talks and claimed that the president had moved the goalposts. I don't think that was a fair estimation. And later on that weekend, when the president was talking to Boehner, he said, John, can you explain what happened to me? Meaning, I was willing to talk and try to work things out, and you bolted. And Boehner, in essence, said to him, I don't want to talk about it.
Just briefly, we have to pledge here in a moment. I'm interested in, it's not the subject of the book necessarily, but I know that you'll have thoughts on this. How intently and how worried is the president about the Supreme Court's deliberations on a signature piece of legislation from him, health care?
You know, I think one thing I took from doing this book is that the president always seems, maybe sometimes too much, to have his eye on the long term, on the long game, and he doesn't get buffeted, and he advises people around him not to be buffeted by the cable news chatter of the nanosecond. Although he does pay attention to what people write and say about him, but he tries to sort of aim further down the road.
Mm-hmm.
And so I haven't spoken to him or people around him about the hearings that are going on this week, the Supreme Court. But my hunch would be that his advice is, listen, what will happen with the court will happen with the court. We will react to it when it happens. Let's make the best arguments we can now. But I do know at the same time, it's interesting that the reelection campaign, has decided to embrace Obamacare. Even the term, which was coined as a derisive term by its opponents, they now say that they're proud of Obamacare, using that word, and that they believe, the campaign strategists believe, that they can present the upside and the benefits of Obamacare, keeping your kids on your plan till they're 26, dealing with pre-existing conditions, things like free mammograms and colonoscopies, that they can promote these things and win the argument, or at least fight to a draw with whoever the Republican nominee is going to be.
David, thank you so much. I hope you'll join us again. Thanks.
Well, thanks for having me. If people are interested in more about Showdown before they run out and buy it or pledge to you to get it, they can either go to my Facebook page, which is David Korn DC, or go to my Twitter feed, which is at David Korn DC, and that's Korn with a C. And you can find more information than you need on my book, Showdown.
Thanks, David. David Corn, the book is Showdown, the inside story of how Obama fought back against Boehner, Cantor, and the Tea Party. Well, it's top of mind. I do want to remind you that if you can pledge $180, we're happy to send you a copy of David Corn's excellent analysis of Inside the Obama White House Showdown. It's WPR.org or 888-202-2552. Ellen Clark joining me in our studios here in downtown Milwaukee. It's our spring membership drive, and we do want to remind you that giving at WPR.org or 888-202-2552 really helps this program thrive. It takes only a few minutes of your time. Please invest in future listening by donating at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And we're looking for 45 pledges this hour. We still need 19 to make the goal, and we need that before 10 o'clock. We can do it with your help. Thank you so much if you've already given to Wisconsin Public Radio, but if you haven't, please take time to pledge right now to help us stay on track, help us meet that goal during Kathleen's hour. Make your contribution right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You've been enjoying the conversation with David Corn about the president, how he dealt with budget deficit and Osama bin Laden in Egypt and the START talks and Don't Ask, Don't Tell, and much more than that. Please take a few minutes to make this hour and many hours to come possible, because you know there is more to come. Put a value on the programs that you enjoy every day and make your pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
You decide the amount of your contribution. That's the nice thing. Every single pledge is appreciated, and every pledge helps us to pay for the programs you love on Wisconsin Public Radio. It is completely up to you. But if you want to, you could consider asking for Showdown as your thank you gift when you pledge $180 or more. And you can do that at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
This July, WPR's Larry Mueller would love to have you and a guest join him at the world's largest flower show in London's Hampton Court Palace. Pledge now to our spring membership drive and you're automatically entered to win two tickets. Explore private gardens, palaces, and castles with Larry and your fellow WPR listeners. For a chance to win two free tickets, pledge right now. No contribution is necessary to win. Visit WPR.org for details.
I'm Kathleen Dunn, Ellen Clark joining me, and we are here to ask for your support of Wisconsin Public Radio. Make your donation in support of the programs you count on. WPR.org, 888-202-2552.
Take a second, think about why you listen to Wisconsin Public Radio. Is it for the information? Is it for the engaging conversations? Is it for the entertainment? Your gift supports that connection for you and others across the state. Our leadership gifts of $1,200 or more are really important to our continued success. So if you can, why not make a leadership gift? Go to WPR.org or call 888-202-2552. But as you know, as always, your gift of any amount is greatly appreciated, and it helps us reach that goal for the hour. We need 17 pledges. Please call now.
Yeah, please call now. It's important we meet those goals. You connect with Wisconsin Public Radio for information, engaging content and entertainment, and your gift supports the connection for you and for others across the state. Leadership gifts of $1,200 and more are increasingly important to our continued success. If you would like to make a leadership gift, go to WPR.org, 888-202-2552, but remember that your gift of any amount is greatly appreciated.
And because you have a strong sense of what it means to be a Wisconsinite, chances are Wisconsin Public Radio plays an important role in that sense of identity for you. We serve the entire state of Wisconsin.
You get news, voices, sounds around the state. Over time, all of these broadcasts add up to a strong sense of connection to the state that we call home.
Wisconsin Public Radio, it's a home we all share, and it's funded in large part by listeners like you. Please give now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
We're looking for how many, Ellen? 16 pledges?
16. We can do it.
In just a few minutes, about 5 minutes. Please, your pledge right now helps pay for the programs you count on. Thank you if you've already given. If you have not, you may want to consider this hour and a pledge of $180 for David Corn's book, WPR.org or 888-202-2552.
And Wisconsin Public Radio exists because people contribute. It's really as simple as that. When we all give, our contributions add up to make this program possible. Your contribution does make a difference.
Please give now, WPR.org or 888-202-2552. It's really very simple. One pledge at a time. You make this station possible.
And remember, you can get our guest book, Showdown, for a pledge of $180, and we need 16 calls to make that goal, so you can help us with that as well.
When you pledge at WPR.org or 888-202-2552, you'll be adding your voice to the almost 50,000 members. That's a lot, isn't it, Ellen, who support Wisconsin Public Radio, and your contribution of any amount joins other member contributions to make up nearly 40% of our budget.
That's important. And we use that money to bring you great programs every single day here on Wisconsin Public Radio. So make your pledge right now at WPR.org or 888-202-2552. And we need 14 calls by the top of the hour. So help us out.
Yeah, please. Remember, pick up a copy of the book Showdown for your pledge of $180 or more. Ellen Clark, thank you so much for coming to be with us this morning. And thank you, everybody, for all of your pledges. They are deeply appreciated. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this hour. And thanks to Rhonda Fanning, who is back from vacation, for on-air production here in our studios. Thanks, everybody, for your calls. Stay with us. An important and interesting hour coming up following the news.